Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You put in your 8 hours, you should get paid at least minimum wage. That's the law. Although that barely keeps the lights on these days, many workers can't take even that transaction for granted. The problem is wage theft. Michael Shields is a researcher with the left-leaning nonprofit think tank Policy Matters Ohio. He recently finished a study of wage theft in Ohio. Michael, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Listeners, coming up later, we'd like to hear from you. If you have been the victim of wage theft, we want to hear your story and the impact it had on you and how you resolved. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Michael, wage theft takes a lot of forms. You focused on wage theft related to minimum wage violations. Why is that?
That's exactly right. There are many forms of wage theft. I looked only at non-payment of the minimum wage, and that's for the simple reason that that is a version of wage theft that we can quantify. There are many forms. Wage theft also includes not paying overtime for hours in excess of 40. It can include misclassifying workers either as salaried so that they're not covered by overtime laws or even as contractors so they're not covered by labor laws at all. Sometimes folks just don't get paid at all. Unfortunately, wage theft is very hard to quantify. We know that most victims never come forward. And so we can see minimum wage non-payment through other data collected by the Census Bureau. So that's the reason that I focused on that.
Okay, how do you collect that? I mean, what kind of data are you talking about? What are you looking at?
This comes from the Current Population Survey. It's a survey that's done every month by the Census Bureau in collaboration with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they ask folks what their wage was. So when I look at the study, I first narrowed down to the workforce of folks who are actually covered by the minimum wage. Some people are not. A lot of farm workers, some domestic workers, folks who are doing door-to-door sales are excluded, but I'm looking specifically at people whose occupations are covered by the minimum wage. And then I'm looking at folks who, when they answered the survey conducted by the Census Bureau, said that their wage was, they report their wage. And when that level is below either the federal or of course, Ohio's minimum wage is a bit higher, that's how I identify the folks who have been victims of minimum wage non-payment, a form of wage theft.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the incidence of wage theft in Ohio. Michael Shields is my guest. He's a researcher with the nonprofit think tank Policy Matters Ohio. He recently finished a study of wage theft in Ohio. So, Michael, you found that Ohio employers steal from an estimated 213,000 workers every year by paying them less than the minimum wage. What does that amount to in terms of dollars?
Sure. It's significant. Most of us work hard to support our families. Here in Ohio, we believe that an honest day's work deserves an honest day's pay. As you noted, I found in my latest report that every year, dishonest employers in Ohio steal from some 213,000 working people just through the minimum wage non-payment. The typical victim loses $2,900 a year if they stay on the job all year long. Now, we don't have a way to count how many weeks if folks are staying on that job the full year. But for those who do, they would lose an average of $2,900. That's about a quarter of their take-home pay. And if we look at all of those wage theft victims together, if they were to keep the job for a year, that's a loss of more than $600 million for the state of Ohio. So really substantial.
When you say it's a quarter of their take-home pay, then you're talking about some of the poorest of the poor in the state.
That's absolutely right. That makes this form of wage theft especially pernicious because these are folks who, by definition, are low pay. To lose something on the order of $2,900, which is the average, that's really substantial for folks.
And you say that, all right, so it's wage theft. Is there any likelihood that some of this is just error?
This is an estimate, so we do expect some error, of course. But we do the best we can to narrow this down to, folks who are covered by the minimum wage. First of all, we identify them by their occupations. And then we're looking at, folks who were paid less. Now, we know that most People who experience wage theft never report it. So this is a substantially higher estimate than what we would see if we would look at like the Department of Labor's record of cases that they've investigated. So we know, you know, whenever you're dealing with a survey, there is some error, but this is a pretty good estimate, I think, and it's consistent with other research that has been done.
As far as the employers that are taking the money purposefully, is there any, can you give us a thumbnail on who that is?
Yeah, for sure. In my study, I found that the leisure and hospitality industry was responsible for more than half of minimum wage non-payment wage theft cases. There are some reasons that that industry is really rife for situations like this. You know, the a lot of folks who work in leisure and hospitality are waiters and waitresses. Folks who are paid tips in Ohio are entitled, of course, to the full minimum wage, which is $9.30 in Ohio right now. But the law is set up so that employers of tipped workers can claim their tips to offset up to half of the minimum wage. So then if the wage falls short between their direct pay and their tips, if it falls short of that $9.30, employers are supposed to make up the difference. By law, they have to. But it creates a situation where it really leaves it to the worker themselves to know their rights and to assert them to the employer. And we know for that reason that you know, many workers do not and feel they don't have the power to do that. So this is an industry where we see really significant cases of wage theft. And one thing that would help to address that is to eliminate that sub-minimum wage for tipped workers and cover workers, even who earn tips, under the same fair minimum wage as everybody else. And by the way, we really do need to raise that wage. But many states do cover tipped workers under the same minimum wage. That's something that Ohio should do as well.
So just the way it stands now, though, I go to work, I work 5 hours, or let's just even say I work 8 hours. I make $100 in tips. 8 hours times $9.30, and then the, you said that the employer can claim tips. How does that work?
Sure. So employers of tipped workers only have to pay a wage of half the minimum wage. Minimum wage is $9.30. Okay. So that would be $4.65. That is only provided that the workers' tips equal another $4.65 an hour, so that in total they're paid the full value of the minimum wage. Employers have to make sure that that happens. Okay. But we know that it really creates a lot of gaps in enforcement, and that very often that does not happen.
I mean, so that requires then the employee to report to the employer what their tips are every night.
Sure. You know, they would have to keep track of their tips, know what those are, do the math, and then come to the employer and say, hey, I've fallen short. You've got to make up the difference. So we know that this very often does not happen.
Are there good actors out there that are doing it the right way?
You know, I'm sure there are. And we know that we've seen some upward pressure on wages in the restaurant industry. So I think that that is it's a positive thing. But unfortunately, we know that, you know, our minimum wage is far too low. It doesn't meet the cost of living. It really doesn't honor the full value of work. We looked at the 10 most common jobs in Ohio just about a month ago and found that four of them pay wages that are so low that a family of three would qualify for food aid in order to meet the cost of food. So we know that low wages continue to be a significant problem in Ohio. You know, that's a separate matter, but it's obviously related to what we're talking about here when folks actually aren't even paid the full wages that they're entitled to.
The overtime issue, you said, is another area of theft. I mean, I know people who keep pretty good track of their overtime because they make more when they work over. Is that the law, or is that a benefit that happens to be part of their workplace?
For most workers, that's the law. There are folks who are exempt. Salaried employees typically are not entitled to time and a half. It depends on their rate of pay. But for the majority of workers, they should be paid at least 1.5 times their regular wage if they're working hours beyond 40 in a week.
And as we said earlier, it's the most vulnerable economically who are the most impacted by this. What is out there to help them negotiate this in any event?
You're absolutely right. You know, wage theft can happen to anybody. For folks listening out there, there's a good chance that it has happened to them. But low-paid people are 5 times as likely to experience wage theft. Women, native Spanish speakers, Asian Americans, people who were born outside of the U.S., all of these folks are more often targeted than others. There are obvious reasons for that. You know, folks who are more likely to be wage theft victims may have limited understanding of their rights at work. They may even have limited English language fluency. And, you know, folks who are actually undocumented can face retaliation from their employers. And that can have really grave consequences, obviously. You know, folks can be separated from their families and deported. So these folks, we know, have fewer job choices in the labor market. These are the folks who are especially likely to experience wage theft, although, again, you know, anybody can. There is recourse. Folks can report claims to the D Department of Labor, the Federal Department of Labor. Ohio also has a Department of Wage and Hour Enforcement. So you can make a direct report. Folks who are looking for help often reach out to one of the worker centers. In Ohio, we have three. We've got a center in Columbus, the Central Ohio Worker Center. Cincinnati has the Cincinnati Interfaith Worker Center. In Cleveland, where I am, we have the Northeast Ohio Worker Center. These are organizations that can help folks to navigate the legal process to claim wages that are owed to them. And oftentimes, you know, just a phone call to the employer can help sort that out. So there is recourse. Unfortunately, there's inadequate enforcement, but there are things that folks can do.
Well, and going back to the issue that it's the most vulnerable, I mean, people who need the job the most maybe are maybe getting paid under the table. That's another issue, right?
You know, I think that's a possibility. One of the things that I really saw is that folks who are most likely to be wage theft victims seem to be folks who have fewer job choices in our labor market, just in general. I actually found evidence of this with Black workers as well. You know, Black and white Ohioans were about equally likely to face wage theft. But one thing that I found was that Black workers put in more hours on the job and lost more money. So these are signs that they're actually more attached to employers who have stolen from them. So we're seeing certainly folks who have fewer choices in the labor market are more likely to face wage theft unfortunately, in some cases, to tolerate it. You know, they may feel that they don't have another option.
Undocumented workers are particularly vulnerable because not only are they being stolen from at the workplace, they don't have access to a lot of programs that are out there for low-income Ohioans.
That is true. And another factor that really affects undocumented workers is that they're vulnerable to retaliation from their employers, especially so. You know,
Threats, it's threats too, right?
yeah, absolutely. You know, the stakes can be really high for folks who are undocumented. Obviously, if an employer does retaliate, you know, the person could be faced with deportation and be separated from their family.
In Ohio, the Bureau of Wage and Hour Administration enforces minimum wage laws. Is that something the Wage and Hour Administration, is that a state thing particularly, or is it a federal arm in Ohio?
That's an Ohio department. And unfortunately, it's understaffed. You know, we've only got 6 wage and hour investigators. That includes a
For
supervisor.
the whole state?
For the whole state. Yeah. And that's for a workforce of nearly 5.8 million. So by comparison, it would be as though we had one police officer for the whole city of Columbus, for instance.
So, but what do you glean at least from that? I mean, are they kept busy or are not, or what?
You know, it's my sense, yes, that they are. But unfortunately, when you don't have enough folks on staff, Ohio is really stuck in this complaint and response model where The only thing that the administration can really do is respond to a complaint if it comes in. But unfortunately, most victims of wage theft never come forward at all. You know, they may not know their rights. They may fear retaliation from their employers, we already touched on, or they may simply think that nothing will be done on their behalf. So most folks never do report. There are ways that administrations can be more effective in preventing wage theft anyway. And the way to do that is through strategic enforcement. That requires going out and forging relationships with people in the communities. You know, we understand that wage theft victims tend to be folks who are the most marginalized. They may be fearful of government agents, so they don't report. So you really have to establish relationships with trusted members of their communities. This is another place where worker centers can be a really effective part of enforcement. But then you also have to go out and look at industries where we know this is really common. In Ohio, we know that one of those industries is leisure and hospitality. So with strategic targeted enforcement, where investigators go out and they set up relationships with community organizations, they proactively go out and look at employers in industries where this happens a whole lot, you can, first of all, prevent a lot more wage theft, and you create an environment in which employers understand, look, wage theft is illegal, but unfortunately, it's very often not treated as such. You know, most employers are never held accountable anyway, because the employees don't report it. And even when they are, oftentimes employers calculate and sometimes correctly calculate that it's worth the cost or it's worth the risk because the penalties can be very low.
Do these tend to be small scale employers, or can they be large scale employers that are but managed at a local level?
You know, it can be either. The Federal Department of Labor keeps a record of employers that have committed have had a lot of findings, or even just a few. But you know, some cases you do see large employers who've had many violations. But one of the things that you also can see is that there's a tendency to among some employers, like large, powerful employers will oftentimes subcontract out work. And then sometimes you'll see subcontractors having really poor labor practices and low wages that, you know, maybe you wouldn't see in a lead firm, but it's immediately, you know, underneath the lead firm within their supply chain. So that's a way that firms can, you know, set themselves sort of outside of the scope of enforcement, either by subcontracting work out to other employers. Sometimes businesses will face wage theft charges, and then they'll just close up shop. You know, a company will unincorporate, and then the same individuals will set up a new company. So that's one thing that happens. And then another thing that we sometimes see is that firms will employ people not as employees who have formal labor protections at all, but as subcontractors. And that may be a form of misclassification. It often is. But if a person is classified as a contractor, not an employee, then they're not protected by labor laws.
Okay. Lots of questions. My guest is Michael Shields. He's a researcher with the nonprofit think tank Policy Matters Ohio. He recently finished a study about wage theft in Ohio. We're going to continue our conversation. Listeners, we're looking for callers. If you've been the victim of wage theft, we want to hear your story, the impact it had on you, and how you resolved it, if you did or if not. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. An exact amount is difficult to pin down, but wage theft costs American workers billions of dollars every year. We're taking a look at the impact of wage theft and how to respond. Still with us is Michael Shields, a researcher with Policy Matters Ohio. He just finished a study of wage theft in Ohio. Janice Fine is a professor of labor studies and employment relations and the director of the Workplace Justice Lab at Rutgers University. She's a leading scholar and public voice on the need for new strategies to effectively enforce labor standards. Janice, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Alexia Fernandez Campbell is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, an independent news organization dedicated to investigating the systems and circumstances that contributed to inequality in our country. Welcome to the show, Alexia.
Thanks for having me.
Alexia, wage theft's been a problem for a long time now. Probably it's probably as old as time. Why does it get so little attention?
Well, I think because of the people that it affects. It's people in very vulnerable positions, people who are very low paid, who may not even realize that they're being ripped off. They might not realize that they're entitled to overtime. You know, and people just, you know, many people probably assume that their bosses are paying them what they should be paid. And so I think a lot of people just don't realize that it's happening. And then because they're in vulnerable positions where they might not complain because they're afraid of getting fired, you know, people just aren't paying attention, or they think it's, you know, it's just a part of doing business.
Janice,
it's definitely studies show that the biggest reason that low wage workers don't complain is for fear of retaliation. And that's a very reasonable fear, because in fact, it happens all the time.
Janice, can you give us a sense about the scale of the problem in the U.S.? Because we have to estimate so much because it's not reported so often.
So what I wanted to say is that Ohio is not alone. This is an excellent study. And there are studies being done across the country, many by the Workplace Justice Lab, that show that that this is a problem in many states. So for example, in New York State, there's estimated 965 million in unpaid minimum wages, estimated to impact 1 in 5 low-wage workers. In Florida, 15% of low-wage workers on average experience minimum wage violations per year. In Oregon, half of hospitality workers have experienced wage theft violations in the last year. I mean, it goes on and on. So, this is definitely a national problem. And you're right that it's very difficult to figure out exactly how to calculate it. And so all of our methods are imperfect. Most of us do it the same way, but it's, you know, there's definitely a lot of room for improvement in terms of how to calculate this.
Are the rules and regulations around minimum wage laws, Janice, are they federal or are they state by state?
So because we live in a federalist society, it means that we have federal wage and hour laws, state wage and hour laws, and sometimes, depending on the city or the county, we also have local wage and hour laws. As a consequence, we have a federal bureaucracy, administration that enforces the law. And we have state, particularly in Northeast, Western, and Midwestern states, there's a history of very strong state departments of labor that, as this study points out, have been in free fall in terms of the resources that have been invested. So there's partly not enough investment in resources, but the other issue is that they're playing whack-a-mole instead of chess. You know, the strategies are extremely backward at this point. So a lot of what's happening is that while people are working really hard at the state level to update our labor laws, whether that's raising the minimum wage or bringing in laws finally that recognize that families need support, like paid sick and safe time and paid family leave, et cetera. The issue is that the policy updates are great, but they're being hitched to backward enforcement regimes. So for example, Alexia alluded to this, complaint-based enforcement mm-hmm. just doesn't work if you're talking about low-wage workers, right? Assuming that everybody who has a problem is gonna come forward, for the reasons that Alexia stipulated, right? They may not know their rights are being violated. If an agency is requiring them to know which law has been violated, people don't know that. And then if they're undocumented, And remember, our labor laws cover everyone, whether they're documented or not. They're also fearful of coming forward. And that was particularly true, of course, under the Trump administration.
So do the, and I haven't asked about consequences to the employers when they are busted for this. Is the are the consequences fractured in the same way? There may be local consequences, maybe not, maybe state, maybe not, maybe federal, maybe not, depending on which law they broke.
So there's a few different things here. One is, are the penalties enough to deter this behavior, right? And the answer is no. Then are the wages actually collected? What happens with collections? And the collections rate is abysmal. And your question about at the different levels, I can't speak to that. I think Michael can, you know, what that looks like in Ohio. So I think maybe it'd be good to hear from Michael about
it. Yeah, Michael, what about consequences? Is it mostly at the state level that they're issued, or what are they?
You know, in the absence of sufficient enforcement across the state, some cities in Ohio have actually started to step forward and implement enforcement strategies. Of course, wage theft is illegal. It's illegal under state and federal law, both. If the Department of Labor is enforcing, they can enforce the federal minimum wage only, $7.25. Ohio can enforce our $9.30 wage. We know that there just isn't enough investment in enforcement.
But is wage theft a felony or is it a misdemeanor? What is it?
So this is a problem.
Okay.
Yeah, it's one of Michael. It's one of your recommendations, right? Is to make it a criminal.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that's really interesting about this, my study found that the typical wage theft victim who keeps their job for a year loses $2,900. Now, if you steal $2,900, ironically, if the employee were to steal $2,900 from their employer,
right,
that would be a felony. In this case, it's not, and it's not treated as a criminal offense generally. Ohio has civil penalties. Ohio actually has penalties up to treble damages, up to three times what the employer stole. We know that is not always enforced. We know that enforcement entities will sometimes treat wage theft as a sort of, training opportunity to just remind employers that they have to pay workers all or part of what they're owed. So the penalties really are not sufficient. At the federal level, legislation has just been introduced. Senator Sherrod Brown introduced legislation that would substantially increase penalties. They would range from $22,000 to over $100,000 for wage theft. And for really egregious cases in which the employer has falsified documents to try to cover up what they've done or has retaliated against an employee who came forward, then they could face criminal charges. Now, there is enforcement on some level locally in Ohio, but one thing that we know is that an employer who has committed wage theft has also committed tax fraud. So there is an opportunity to prosecute.
Alexia Fernandez-Campbell, you found that the U.S. Postal Service is one of the worst offenders when it comes to wage theft. What's going on there?
Yeah, it was really surprising because we filed a Freedom of Information Act request for all the wage theft violations at the federal level from the Department of Labor. And when we were looking through all the data, I noticed that USPS was like one of the worst violators. And so I was like, what is going on here? This is like a semi-public agency. But I guess they fall under the Department of Labor as far as enforcement goes. So I was looking into it. I reached out to, the labor unions. I reached out to actual postal workers and they sent me information. And they're basically what was happening is they're under so much pressure to keep costs down that we found like 250 managers in 60 different post offices were just deleting people's their time cards, like literally deleting hours from their time cards.
Even though they had nothing personally to gain, they were just doing it to keep their own job.
Yeah. So what the postal workers are telling me, like, this is so common and we'll complain to the unions. And yeah, sometimes we'll get our money back, but they just keep doing it over. No consequences. So they just keep doing it over and over. Yeah, so it's not like their supervisors are keeping the money. It's just that they're getting a lot of heat from up above to keep the overtime costs down. And so some of the Postal Service workers just told me, yeah, we told that we have to clock out at 6 p.m. even if we're still out delivering mail. So many of them they're so afraid of losing their job that they would just keep working without pay.
I want to take a call here right now. Deb in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Deb.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I want to make a comment. For 15 years, I worked at a major tax preparation organization. And off and on, I would see regular Americans, not fresh off the boat, not fresh from different country, people well-established here in the U.S. of A. They would come in with W-2s, same workplace, same boss, but one W-2 would have employer name X, then would be employer name Y, and they would have the wages divided in half. And I would ask, I said politely, are you by chance working overtime, not getting paid for it? And they would either not realize it or said no. And I had to kind of wonder about that because I would ask them, they're in the same building, the same bosses, the same job. And I had to kind of wonder if that's just a way to not pay overtime because that's a lot of money when your wage is, cut in half, but it's an employer X, employer Y.
Right, and it probably could affect benefits and all kinds of things, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, Janice Fine, that sounds super nefarious.
It's really interesting. I'm so glad you're raising this, the caller's raising this, because there was a study done recently about how electronic payroll, which we tend to think makes it more possible to comply, sometimes provides employers with sophisticated ways of evading payment, right? So it's a kind of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's a way that employers, particularly small businesses, very small businesses, can comply with the law, right? Can set electronically sort of what they have to pay and then stick to it. On the other hand, when we go to accountants, often they'll tell us how to pay the least, right? And the same thing is true with companies. And so we shouldn't assume that when they're setting up their payroll systems or there's all sorts of ways. And this is the thing that I think is fundamental about this problem. It's the power difference between employees and their employers, right? It's the asymmetry of power and information that makes this so hard. And the record keeping is a huge issue. In some cases, we see low-wage workers who don't have payroll stubs, don't have records at all. And in other cases, there are various schemes to evade responsibility. I'll just say one more thing, and then I see Alexia's got something to add.
We have to take a quick break.
Oh, okay.
So hold on to that. Stick a pin in it. Yeah. We'll get back. There's lots to talk about. Right. Okay. That is Janice Fine. She is a professor of labor studies and employment relations and the director of the Workplace Justice Lab at Rutgers University. Also with us, Michael Shields, a researcher with the nonprofit think tank Policy Matters Ohio. He recently finished a study of wage theft in Ohio. And Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. It's an independent news organization dedicated to investigating the systems and circumstances that contributed to inequality in our country, which is just what Janice Fine was getting at. So we'll get to it. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the problem of wage theft in the U.S. Still with us, Michael Shields of Policy Matters Ohio, Janice Fine, director of the Workplace Justice Lab at Rutgers University, and Alexia Fernandez-Campbell, a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Janice, let's go back to what you were saying about how this exacerbates an already growing gap in terms of just financial agency in this country.
Well, I just want to say we have to bear in mind that with 6% of private sector workers in unions today, so that's 94% of private sector workers are solely reliant on these public laws and on their enforcement. So that's a really, really important thing to bear in mind. And then on top of that, what I was going to say is that a lot of these agencies have not kept pace with the radical restructuring of employment relations, right? The rise of subcontracting, the rise of independent contracting. And so part of what agencies are figuring out how to do is what we call strategic enforcement. And that's figuring out how to get to the top of the food chain, how to hold multiple entities responsible, not just the entity that's actually signing off on a paycheck.
The individual, in other words, not the dealer, but the drug lord is, I guess, what you're talking about, right?
Right. Okay. That's a really good description.
I'm just trying to figure out the ways that people might. And right. When you talk about this growing, you know, this changing work economy, we kind of sexily refer to it as the gig economy. They must be that must be a big problem as well.
Yeah. I mean, the gig economy is a problem for sure. And, you know, the truth is there are so many workers who are now gigging, who in years past, these were good full-time jobs with, you know, that helped workers make it into the middle class, whether that's, you know, janitorial, trucking, these guys can help me. I mean, there's so many different industries that were good jobs and, you know, have been subcontracted to death to the point where, and, you know, it's been a careful strategy on the part of
Well, they call it privatization is what it was happening in Ohio for a long time. Everything got privatized and that was better because letting the private economy do it. And, you know, we're a capitalist society, blah, blah, blah. Alexia Fernandez Campbell, guest workers are particularly vulnerable. They may be here legally. They may be documented, but they're guest workers and they're particularly vulnerable. How come?
Yeah, I mean, the guest worker program in the U.S. has so many flaws. And one of the biggest flaws is just that, you know, people come into this country all the time on like these guest worker visas, mostly from Mexico. And they're here to work on the farms, you know, like in Ohio and in California, or they're seasonal workers in hotels or ski resorts. And they'll come for, you know, on like a 3 to 6 month visa to work, but they can only work for that one employer who sponsors them. So, you know, the money they're making compared to where they, you know, in Mexico is a lot of money. That's like $9 an hour. It's a lot of money to them. So they're not going to complain about anything because they can't work for anyone else. If they complain, they're just not going to get another next year. They're not going to be called back by their employer.
And there's no consequences for that.
I mean, we looked at the data and I mean, they are doing very few investigations. The Department of Labor at the federal level, they're the only ones who, and correct me if I'm wrong, they're the only ones who investigate wage theft amongst the guest workers. And there's like, it's tripled. The number of guest workers that are coming in every year has tripled in the last 10 years. And they're only like, let's say they're 300,000 in 2019. They're only doing like 400 investigations. And that's either part of the reason because people are too afraid to come forward. They're afraid of losing their visas or getting, you know, basically losing their, this pipeline. And the Department of Labor, you know, they're not really, I didn't see any consequences. Like they just have to pay back some wages. And sometimes they don't even do that. So they're not getting penalized. That's for sure.
Michael Shields, I wanted to start the conversation about the larger impact on everybody when some people, particularly the most vulnerable, are not getting their fair pay.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if folks aren't being paid the full value of their wage or being paid less than the minimum wage, you know, that certainly hurts the bargaining power that workers have more generally. You know, to have this kind of substratum in the workforce where we have folks who are, you know, specifically targeted because they're vulnerable, you know, that's certainly something that's going to push wages down. For other workers as well. This is something that, you know, folks are stakeholders even if they themselves are not wage theft victims. And it's frankly something that businesses should be concerned about as well, because if an employer is not paying the full value of the minimum wage, they're reaping a labor cost advantage over their counterparts who are following the law. So businesses certainly should be vested in that as well. And I did want to make just one note about Janice had talked a little bit about how little union density we have now and how that has really affected folks. That actually came through in my study as well. I found that folks who belong to a union are half as likely to experience wage theft through minimum wage nonpayment as those who are not represented.
I guess that's what surprised me about the USPS, Alexia, is that the union couldn't be more a better advocate for its workers in this case.
Yeah, that was a weird situation. The postal workers I spoke to say their unions are way too cozy with the Postal Service, that they're very afraid. And the postal, like the unions did not want, I actually had to get information from like the union reps at the very local level, like the leadership and the unions, they are very afraid of saying anything negative. They're not like the private sector unions who will like just like be very critical and very like transparent about what's going on. They're very afraid of pissing off the Postal Service. So they think that has something to do with it. You know, and also in their contract, it doesn't say that there are any penalties for committing wage theft. Like, so they could negotiate a contract that would be like, hey, there, you know, if you commit wage theft, not only do you have to pay back the money, but X needs to happen. And it's not in their contract. So they could negotiate a more stricter contract where there would be consequences for the supervisors who do this, I'm assuming, and they just don't. So there's just no way to basically punish supervisors or the Postal Service for doing this.
Janice Fine, is this during this time when there's such a demand for workers? Hypothetically, would this be less likely to be occurring about now or not necessarily? What do we know about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, I think the research is mixed. I mean, for sure, we're in a moment when more workers are organizing and more workers are demanding attention and are demanding higher wages and benefits and willing to walk out and go somewhere else because they have more labor market power than they used to. And that's actually true for some low wage workers as well in some sectors, you know, where we see that retail stores and restaurants and others are just dying for employees and that, you know, other companies are offering various kinds of incentives to workers. So, yeah, I mean, I think that they have more leverage. And I think that also college grads who are coming out and going into some of these jobs just are much more willing to go toe-to-toe with the boss. I see it with my own students, you know, just indulge me for a sec.
Sure.
Years ago, I would have undergrads and master's students who would come in and basically say, I don't need a union. I don't need an organization. I'm going to cut my own deal with the employer. Now I never hear that, you know, and particularly with young people who are, you know, who are now baristas and all these other jobs, right? These are kids who thought that they were going to have a higher standard of living than their parents, you know, that thought that they were gonna, you know, I ask my students, what do you want from your job? And they go through this long list. First, they don't wanna live to work, right? But then the other thing is they want benefits, they want wages, they want off for childcare, they want maternity and paternity leave, you know, I mean, it's a good solid right list, right? And then they're graduating into our, you know, dramatically laissez-faire employment relations system where almost everything it's Lord of the Flies out there, right?
Well, I guess the bottom line is what good are protections without enforcement? Let's see, Rick in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Rick.
Hi, love your show, loyal listener. I wish you guys would be on television to get out to less of a niche market that's listening to this stuff. But my comment is, until labor boards or enforcement or all the organizations that you're speaking to on this show, until they proactively go, and it would have to be anonymously because that's the only way you're going to get anybody to fill out one of these forms, is do what I've done in managing large departments of car dealerships, is do employee satisfaction index scores and find out what's going on, because it's not only happening at minimum level wage levels. It's happening. It was happening to me, and I was a highly paid manager of a large department in a car dealership, and the general manager, as well as the corporate owners, had me sign contracts that said any incentives that I got, that I won from performance, that when I won them, they would go, quote, to the general manager's desk. So I won an iPad, and I didn't get the iPad, although the franchise had my Social Security number that I paid tax on for income, but the general manager swiped the iPad because that's the way it's done in this corporation. So embrace it. That's wow. happening at all levels, but you will never get anybody to call and say, hey, this is being done, because for me fighting that, I was literally blackballed in the industry because I was fighting management.
Wow. Okay. So Rick's making a pretty, I mean, what does that suggest to you, Janice, finding your work?
Rick, I'm so glad you called. This is so good, because you're right. I think sometimes we don't talk enough about middle-class workers who are also suffering, you know, overall from this economy, but for sure who've experienced wage theft exactly the way you describe it. And, you know, it's absolutely true. And it's so good you pointed it out, because, you know, the analogy is restaurant workers whose tips get pocketed, right, by their managers. Your tips got pocketed, right? And it's not even your tips, right? You won this for fair and square for your salesmanship. And you had a manager who was able to take it. So, you know, I guess that's what we're all talking about, is that standing up to the boss individually for the reasons that Rick shared, right? That there's blacklisting of various kinds, there's retaliation. You know, we all know stories of middle-class people who got fired from their jobs because their supervisors didn't like them. Or, you know, these are the arbitrary and capricious reasons that why unionization is so important, because when workers can come together, have a collective voice, have a contract, these kinds of behaviors are less likely to happen. And that's what I feel like we're at a moment where there's a new national conversation about employee rights. It's an exciting moment.
Right. I mean, Michael Shields, or Alexia, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, talking about, you know, middle class workers like myself, you know, I went to college, I have a white collar job. And in the newspaper industry, like I started out, there was no unionizing in the newsrooms. And now it's getting a lot more. And like I worked at Vox.com. And now where I work now, we're two union newsrooms. And just that, having the knowing that I can't get fired for just, you know, because someone doesn't like the way I look or like something I said, like, it's amazing, like, what a difference that makes. Like, you know, I have to be fired for like a reason, like either my performance or I did something like outrageously egregious. Like, it's not that I could just be fired because someone didn't like me for something I said that, you know, they thought sounded weird. Like, it's just, it's crazy to think that so many people could just be fired for, like, you know, no reason whatsoever. Well, like, your job security.
I grew up in the news media business, in the newspaper business, when unions were strong, and worked at non-union and union papers. And the unions made the non-union papers more respectful, more honest. So, I mean, I think it cuts both ways. But you're right, during the deterioration of the traditional print media, the unions have broken down a lot. We are out of time. Obviously, there's a lot more to talk about. Michael Shields, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Michael Shields is a researcher with the nonprofit think tank Policy Matters Ohio. He recently finished a study about wage theft in Ohio, which inspired this program. Janice Fine, a professor of labor studies and employment relations and director of the Workplace Justice Lab at Rutgers University. Thanks for your time as well today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me in.
And Alexia Fernandez-Campbell is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. That's an independent news organization dedicated to investigating the systems and circumstances that contribute to inequality in our country. Alexia, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
It was great to be here.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.